From RunAsRadio.com, you're listening to Run As Radio, the internet audio talk show for IT professionals with Richard Campbell and Greg Hughes. This is Brandon Wen announcing show number 133 with guest Sahil Malik, recorded Sunday, November 1st, 2009. Run As Radio is produced each week by Pwop Productions, providing professional media and podcasting services online at pwop.com. You can follow the boys on Twitter at twitter.com/runasradio.
Thank you very much. It's Richard Campbell. With me, as always, my co-host, Greg Hughes.
Yes, you are, and yes, I am. How are you today?
I'm well, sir. Want to do a Run As Radio?
Yeah, let's do something.
Why not?
Yeah, you know, it's always fun.
It's always fun. How was your honeymoon, Bob?
The honeymoon was great. We went to Hawaii on the Big Island, on the dry side, the Kona Coast. Never been there before. We had a terrific time. Now we're back. Glad to be back, but sorry to leave kind of thing.
Oh, yeah,
but,
no kidding.
No, it was terrific. Thanks for asking.
Oh, no worries. Hey, let's just dive right into this because we've got our regular troublemaker here. Sahil Malik, a .NET author, trainer, consultant who's worked on Microsoft technology since the DOS days. He's heavily invested in SharePoint, and he loves it.
Yeah, it's me. Hi.
SharePoint's your friend, Sahil. You told me that yourself.
It is, and but it's just tonight, you know, for today, let's stop talking about SharePoint. Let's talk about Greg's honeymoon instead.
The analogies will abound, yes,
well,
I'm sure.
Has 2010 actually shipped now, Sahil?
No, it hasn't. And it'll ship sometime in the first half of 2010,
okay,
which a lot of us are translating to May 31st.
Nice.
That's logical.
Just the first half.
Yeah, but you know, we don't exactly know what the date would be, but Beta 2 is going to be out at the end of November, and the NDA has finally been lifted, so we can start talking about it.
Oh, yeah.
Good. Finally.
And of course, I know you've been tortured by this, because we've done other shows with you, and you already knew a bunch about what was going on in 2010, but it was all a secret.
Yeah, I know. It's hard to keep a secret. And I've been working with 2010 for more than a year now. I started working on it August of last year. And the last show that we did was more on the 2007 lines. It was more on the lines of talking about challenges that we faced on 2007.
Yep. Right.
Now, but you know, there are a lot of shows that, you know, that have been done on what is good about 2007. There's plenty of good about 2007. But everybody does those shows. So we took one that was a little bit more practical, but specifically the things that we picked in the previous show were things that were going to be addressed very well in SharePoint 2010, which we can talk about freely now.
So let's do that. What is it? Why do we care about SharePoint 2010? And what do we have in store?
Okay. So there are a lot of things, and we'll try and cover as many as we can in this show. I would say from an IT pro side of things, what are the things about SharePoint 2010 that make me excited? Probably at the top of the list would be the re-architected services model.
Wow, that's big. That's huge. So literally the core services, they've changed the way it's laid out.
Exactly. So, you know, earlier in SharePoint 2007, you had something called as the shared service provider.
Right.
And as I'd mentioned in the previous show, that the shared services provider, the biggest limitation of that was that you could have one website could be managed by one shared service provider at a point only.
Yep.
So that created a scalability issue. That created a flexibility issue. But what they've done this time around is that in SharePoint 2010, there will be no shared services provider. Instead, there will be just services that you can manage and administer independent of each other. And when I say manage and administer independent of each other, what you can do is that for SharePoint 2010, you can go into central administration, manage services, and you can pick a service and you can appoint an administrator on a per service basis.
Sorry, so give us examples just to be clear about what these services are. I can appoint administrators over what different components or services?
Well, as an example, one of the services could be user profile import. You know, this is something that would run in the background. Another service would be search. And, rather than having one farm administrator who is responsible for everything under the sun and the poor guy is overloaded and looking for a new job by now, this person can now delegate the management of these services on a one-by-one basis. Another example of such services could be Excel services, for instance.
Gotcha.
So the idea here is that you can assign someone to only have the privileges to do administration of the users. They don't get access to anything else.
User profiles, right. So you can appoint administrators on a per-service basis. So you just select a service and click the administrators button on the ribbon, and then those users will be given access to central admin, but they can only manage the service that you designated them to.
That's cool. Right. That sounds grown up, actually. This is the way SQL Server's done it forever.
Right. SharePoint's growing up, finally.
Finally.
It's grown fatter, too.
And it's about time.
Yeah, it's grown a lot fatter. Okay. So another advantage of this is that services can now be offered to sites on an a la carte basis. So earlier what you had was the website that you associated the SSP with got everything that the SSP offered, whether or not you needed it. So if you don't need Excel services, well, you still get it. It's a part of the package. So
right.
It's like an all-you-can-eat buffet style. But now you have the ability to offer certain services to certain sites or split a service between a number of sites.
Mm-hmm.
And the advantage of that is that typically in hosted scenarios where somebody doesn't want Excel services, so maybe now the licensing on this, I believe, is still being worked out, but you still have the possibility of if somebody doesn't want Excel services and possibly they don't want to pay for it, you have, at least technically speaking, you have the possibility of not offering them Excel services, whereas somebody else on the same farm can be offered Excel services.
Oh, okay.
So that's nice. Then another advantage that you have because of the re-architected services model is that now you can scale your services to more than one machine. And so you can have a separate farm whose job is nothing but to offer services. So the consumer farm and the provider farm can communicate to each other using service proxies, and you can have a farm whose job is nothing but to provide services to other farms.
Now, why would you do that?
Well, one, from a scalability perspective, that once you have the ability to split out a certain service into more than one machine as a proper farm.
Does it also impact things like high availability? Does it give you better options in terms of making sure that you have good resiliency?
Exactly. And another advantage is data segregation. For example, maybe you have a situation where you've got multiple SharePoint farms and you have some extranet users and some intranet users, and you don't want those user profiles to get mixed up with each other. So for that service, potentially you could have two separate farms or two separate machines. And two separate instances of the service running, and you could communicate to each other and share that service with the separate farms.
That could substantially change the extranet story, couldn't it?
Absolutely, it would make it a lot better. Absolutely.
Yeah.
Because right now, if you want to provide extranet access, pretty much anybody who gets into your SharePoint has access to all of it.
Anything that's on the farm. That's right, especially on the side of user profiles. Right.
Right. Right.
So multiple Active Directories, separate shared services, but yet they can interact with each other. Am I hearing you right?
Yeah. And as I said, in the previous version, there were solutions to all of these problems, but all of those solutions were cumbersome.
Right.
And now we have a solution coming out of Microsoft, so everybody's going to do it in one consistent manner. So that's always nice.
Right. Just makes it easier.
Right, exactly. Now, there are a couple of gotchas about sharing services. One of them is that not all services can be or should be shared. So services that generally have their own databases can be shared. And another ramification of that is that you would think that sharing services would also require the consumer farm service accounts to get access to the databases of the provider farm databases. That's really not the case because the consumer always proxies through the provider, and therefore you can have services that are in different Active Directories, and the need for direct SQL permissions to the parent farm's configuration of service databases doesn't arise. So that's some good thinking on their part, where you don't need to give direct SQL rights to the child farms or the consumer farms configuration or service databases.
So is this effectively being managed as a role? The services are being managed as role-based access and SQL. So SQL permissions per se don't apply?
Well, SQL permissions do apply, but they apply only within one farm. But anytime you want to go across farms, the farms will communicate to each other over proxies, and therefore the database access is still limited to the local service accounts, not the other guy's service accounts.
Gotcha. Okay, that makes sense. Sure.
All right, and these all sound like scalability features. Like, these are all things that will let me build a much larger system. I also get additional, you know, security granularity, but if I really want to build a big SharePoint farm here, I've got these new features to really help me.
And manageability too.
Right.
So, okay. So that's probably one of the things that as an IT pro is extremely exciting as far as SharePoint 2010 goes. The second one is that any SharePoint project that we dealt with, most of them required some custom code.
Right.
And the custom code was deployed using solutions and features.
Mm-hmm.
The problem was that when somebody is deploying a solution and feature, by definition means that they have access to the file system. And by definition, if they have access to the file system and they can do things like impersonation without providing passwords,
right,
they had a lot of rights on the SharePoint 2007 server.
Sure.
So even without a password, using custom code, you could impersonate to the SharePoint / system account, and you could go edit a list that you would otherwise not have access to. So there are good reasons why it's architected this way, but administrators are always a little bit nervous because the reality is nobody had the bandwidth to audit every piece of code that was deployed to your SharePoint server.
Right.
And in the real world, you just wouldn't do it. So it was difficult to guarantee, especially if you had a large installation and you had two farm administrators, and you know, you had five development teams and everyone was showing up with their solutions to be deployed.
Yeah.
It was difficult to guarantee that those solutions won't hurt your server, for one. And it was difficult to guarantee that those solutions won't interfere with each other. And it was difficult to guarantee that any one of those solutions doesn't have a while true system.threading.sleep. Right?
Something to basically kill the machine.
Basically kill the machine, right. It was difficult to guarantee all of those scenarios. Now, in SharePoint 2010, you have a concept of farm-based solutions and sandbox solutions. So farm-based solutions are still what are the equivalent of the solutions that we're used to now. So farm-based solutions are something that a farm admin will install, and they have unfettered access to the server.
Right.
Okay.
But now they've introduced another level of solutions, which is sandbox solutions. And sandbox solutions are solutions that, as the name suggests, run in a little sandbox. So they run in a little protected environment. So they cannot do that much damage to your server. So sandbox solutions are prevented from doing certain things, and as a result, they're safer. Also, they can be monitored by the administrator. So the administrator can do things such as, you can say, this site will not deploy more than 300 solutions. Or if this site deploys a solution, it will not consume more than a certain amount of CPU. And if it does it, stop that solution. So it'll intercept that and it'll pause. It'll stop the execution of the rogue solution.
Now, does it stop it permanently, or is this just stops that one instance of it and then allows it to try again? Or what are the limitations there?
It'll allow it to try it again. But then if it tries doing it again, it'll stop it again. So, and then you can also have, you can, using custom code, you can build reporting on top of this, where you have the ability to see, well, this site has been consuming so many CPU resources. So just like a decent virtualized infrastructure, where you're managing a farm of virtual servers, and you would over time, manage its CPU utilization and say, well, you guys are using a lot of CPU, so here's some more. Or you're not using enough, we're going to take away some. So, you know, you have the ability or the insight into your server to be able to do all that with some custom code now.
Yeah, and I was thinking you could do this in 2007 by using virtual machines as your isolation.
Right.
But this is an easier way to go about it.
And again, if you say virtual machines as an isolation, that by definition means that you are... you know, you can't be a part of the same SharePoint farm because
right.
your stuff is going to run on any web head, at least the ones that your site is provisioned on. So it wasn't a good isolation. Practically, to get isolation earlier was that you just create your own farm, and your own farm would be 5 machines at the minimum. So it was expensive.
Right. Is there a layer where the sandbox provides some access into the farm as well as some isolation, so it's sort of in between the total virtual approach?
Yeah, I'm kind of curious, what are the restrictions that are put on a sandboxed solution as well?
Well, the layer is really not, it's not a negotiable layer. What I mean is that it's not, a sandbox solution can do certain things, and that's what it can do. You don't have a negotiation going on over there that allows you to impersonate and do certain other things, and because that would sort of defeat the purpose. So you don't have that, you don't have that bargaining going on. You can't impersonate and do more things, because one other thing that sandbox solutions will allow you to do, that because they're safer and because they are the administrator can, they're more restricted, so the administrator can have more control on what the sandbox solutions can do. The administrator can now delegate the uploading of these sandbox solutions to the site collection administrators. So the site collection administrator doesn't have to go through the administrator to install their solution. What they can do is they can just go to site action, site settings, and in there is a new thing called as a solution gallery. And the solution gallery is where they would upload their WSP, which should contain a sandbox solution, and make their features available using that.
So what are the limitations that are put on a sandbox solution? How are they operationally different in the detail from a standard solution?
So, the sandbox solutions support things such as you can create a list definition, a list instance, you can create content types and fields, you can affect the navigation of your site collection, you can write web parts, you can have event receivers at item event receiver, list event receiver, or web event receiver. You can create custom actions as long as those custom actions are within your site collection. And you can do workflows, and I may be forgetting one or two. But I guess your question is probably, what can sandbox solutions not do? What are they prevented from doing? So they are prevented from doing web application scope features or farm scope features, and editing custom actions that affect central administration, and also certain things that you'll run into. Honestly, all of these weren't documented, so I ran into a few that weren't documented, where, say, if I was trying to affect the page layout using a sandbox solution, making an AJAX call or asynchronous call from the code behind, then that was also blocked. So things in general that potentially could affect the running of your server are blocked in sandbox solutions.
So the sandbox solutions, that's a pretty big deal from just a day-to-day management and operations standpoint, from a security quality standpoint. What else in 2010 really stands out as as a big improvement or something that's just brand new?
Okay. So again, from an IT pro side of things, another thing that stands out is much improved backup and recovery scenarios. So one of the things that we'd had to do very frequently in SharePoint 2007 is that we had to have a backup and recovery farm. Mm-hmm. So as an example, what would happen is a user would delete a document. Well, okay, fine. I can go pick that document from the content database. So that's great. But then sometimes they would delete a site, which doesn't go in the recycle bin. Or they would go delete a site collection, and that doesn't go in the recycle bin.
Right.
And believe me, I've done it.
It's entirely too easy to do, right?
Yeah, because it's, are you sure you want to delete this? And it's late at 8 p.m. at night and you're working, you just hit the space bar, and then you go, oh, crap.
I just deleted everything.
Exactly. So now what they've provided is that you have the ability to attach a content database and what they call as content recovery, and you can restore a site collection or something else from that previous content database without having the need for a separate backup, restore, recovery farm.
And is the backup and restore now more granular? It used to be you had to restore quite a bit. You couldn't actually pick and choose what you wanted to restore.
Yeah, restore
right.
Site.
Earlier, what you had to do is that you would have to restore an entire content database.
Right.
And if the content database contained 5 site collections, you would get all the 5 site collections back.
Right. Yeah.
And it wasn't actually as simple as that because some of the site collections may interfere with the URLs of the existing site collections, maybe a newer version. So then what you'd have to do is that you would have to remove the current content database, then restore the previous content database, then pull that one site collection out or the one item out that you were interested in, and then, detach the old content database and reattach the current content database and then restore this thing that you pulled out in the current content database. So
done that. Been there, done that.
Yeah, sucks. Yeah. I'm getting cold sweats just hearing this described.
So again, the issue with this is that it would definitely cause some downtime on your production farm if you did this on your production farm. So you wouldn't do this on your production farm. You would have a separate recovery farm.
Right,
right.
And so they've basically obviated the need for that recovery farm. Now what you can do is that you can just point to a content database, attach it, and then the content database becomes available to you in a read-only form, and you can extract parts of it out and then restore those parts into your current content database. So it makes things a whole lot more convenient.
Substantially, for sure.
And a corollary of that is that you can now attach a read-only content database to a farm, so that allows users to view content within site collections, but not change it.
That's kind of cool.
It's very useful because I was thinking that this would be very useful in enterprise content management scenarios where, let's say, that your organization gets audited and you want to put a freeze on the current state of content at a global level, then you would simply change that site collection to read-only or that content database to read-only, and bingo, you're now guaranteed that people can still access the content, but they can't change it anymore.
Right. Yeah, from an audit perspective, that's pretty compelling. But also from a sort of recovery perspective, to be able to have that read-only state be able to go through things.
Just spin it up and look at it.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Oh, absolutely.
Again, this sounds very SQL Server. This is something I would do in SQL Server, is bring a database up into a read-only state.
Right, right. So SharePoint is basically just building on that. Absolutely, same concepts. It's becoming more and more mature. And also from another scenario that helps is in a high availability scenario. Because what you can do now is that you can create a log-shipped content database to a secondary location. And let's say that your main farm goes down, then users can automatically start browsing a read-only version of the farm on the secondary farm before the failover has taken place.
Cool.
So this would be an easy way to implement high availability with reduced functionality, so your users won't complain. But as you said many times, Richard, if you want 100% high availability, that's extremely expensive.
Yeah.
But if for those few minutes, users can access the content in a read-only form, and it is cheap to implement that, then a lot of organizations will probably make use of it.
Yeah, that's the 99% solution for a tenth of the price.
Exactly, exactly. So in this case, it probably is a 90% solution for 1% of the price. Exactly.
Yeah. And I think a lot of folks are going to find that worth it. It's just some way to get back to what I absolutely had to have.
Exactly. I think many people will end up making use of that.
What's the story?
Pardon me?
From an IT pro perspective, what is the story? What does it look like to migrate from SharePoint 2007 to 2010?
Oh, I'm glad to say that the migration from 2007 to 2010 will be a lot less painful than the migration from 2003 to 2007.
Well, we hope so.
I guess the only big hump I see in the migration to 2010 would be the higher requirements for hardware and software. The SharePoint 2010 is 64-bit only.
Right.
And it requires SQL 2008 and Windows 2008.
Okay.
Requires. You need to have these current licenses.
Yep. And a lot of large organizations still are heavily vested in Windows 2003 and SQL 2005, even SQL 2000.
Yep.
So, but over time, I guess, you know, when they have enough reason to migrate to 2008 and they see the advantages that SharePoint 2010 brings them, I'm hoping a lot of them will upgrade to newer technologies. So, but from an actual upgrade perspective, it's one of the things that I was really happy to see is that in SharePoint 2010, the UI has changed a lot. So they've replaced, you know, the current SharePoint UI with a ribbon-based UI.
Oh, nice.
And yeah. So what they call is a visual upgrade, that you can upgrade your SharePoint farm to 2010, but you can choose to continue to run 2007 UI.
Oh, okay.
Even though you're, yeah, so your users don't get confused. And even though you are running your servers or your entire applications on 2010 now, but it'll still look and feel like 2007. And site collection by site collection, you can upgrade the UI experience, and then the users will gradually get used to it.
Well, and that's smart, too, because a lot of users fumble with the ribbon. So the fact that you can take your time moving across that. I don't want to jump away from this upgrade yet, because I think this is not, it's, you know, you said upgrade is going to be better, but it still sounds like typical 2007 deployment is 2003 R2 on the operating system, 2005 in SQL Server. So you're going to have to do your OSs first, then your database, and then upgrade SharePoint.
Well, we were, for a long time, we were, even for 2007, we were saying that you should try and, stay on 64-bit operating systems.
Yeah.
And now let's say that if you are running on Windows 2003, the first step would be to change over to Windows 2008-based, SharePoint 2007.
Right.
And then you can run the various upgrade tools to upgrade to SharePoint 2010.
So then you're talking about an upgrade in place.
Pardon me?
You're talking about an in-place upgrade as opposed to a build a new system and migrate. Is that what you're talking about?
That would be an in-place, which would be the, let's say, the Mac approach of things, that you just push a button and it gets everything done. Of course, if you wanted to piecemeal upgrade, you could always move the content databases one by one from 2003, or Windows 2003 to Windows 2008 and SQL 2005 to SQL 2008.
Right.
And then you could attach those content databases in SharePoint 2010 and do an upgrade on those one by one.
Okay.
Okay.
Yeah, because I would think in a production environment, you would build new infrastructure with 2008 and so forth and migrate things across.
I think it depends on the production environment. I think the smaller shops will probably be okay with doing a one-shot upgrade.
Yeah.
But yeah, larger installation, especially ones with a lot of custom code. Anytime we talk of upgrade, the thing that worries me the most is custom code, because that's where a lot of best practices have been not followed. Mm-hmm. And then those are the ones that will break when you upgrade to the next version. And as a result, frequently what happens in larger installations is that you just think of re-architecting the project because then you can also take advantage of the newer features of the product.
What about reverse compatibility on custom code? Are there any gotchas there? Is this have they kept things backward compatible, or what do you anticipate people are going to see?
I mean, that's one of the best things about Microsoft that, you know, the edit.com that was written in DOS works on Windows 7. So it's still the same core, still the same engine. So most of it is backwards compatible. Now, there are things that have been deprecated, things that they don't recommend doing anymore. Example, you know, when you created views in SharePoint 2007, you had to write gobs and gobs of really ugly CAML-based code.
Yeah.
So that's been replaced by XSLT-based views, which is a lot nicer. However, the older stuff will still run.
Okay.
Then you have STPs, notably, site templates, have been deprecated, and there is a newer, better way of doing that using the WebTemp CAML tag.
So my old site templates will or will not work?
They'll work. But
oh, okay.
If you're creating new stuff, you shouldn't be using them. So, and truthfully, I always stayed away from site templates because they caused a lot of problems.
Right.
You know, it was just a lot easier to write features, to sort of automate what people were trying to do. So I stayed away from STPs anyway. And a lot of us did. So which is why they came up with a better solution for that.
Well, I guess my cautionary question and approach here has to do with, you know, first being introduced with SharePoint 2001 and going to 2003 and then 2007 and seeing the, you know, what is a web part change a few times. And so it's at least heartening to know that the things that we've worked on 2007 will be able to operate on 2010 in order to ease that migration, not have to do everything at once.
Oh, yeah. And another thing to consider is, like, you know, the list view web part that was introduced in SharePoint 2003 was not like the web parts that you were supposed to write in 2007.
Right.
But it still worked, and it was used heavily, and it'll still work in 2010 as well.
Okay.
Sahil, we're running out of time here. Any final words about 2010?
Yeah, I'll just one little. Nice thing to have is that SharePoint 2010 uses PowerShell heavily. So you can just activate a feature and get a whole library of PowerShell commandlets, like hundreds of them.
Right.
And that just makes managing SharePoint a ton easier.
That's very good.
You bet.
All right, Sahil, thanks so much for filling us in. I'm excited to see what 2010 is going to bring us.
Yeah, thanks, Sahil.
Thank you. Me too.
And we'll talk to you next time on Run As Radio.